This is episode 315 of That Shakespeare Life. Just like the work of William Shakespeare, That Shakespeare Life is made possible by listeners just like you who sign up to be our patrons. Join us today at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife and stay tuned after the episode for even more details.
Hey, I'm Lauren Lieba, Assistant Teaching Professor of Game Studies at Penn State Yerry Barron College. Another great method for studying the life of William Shakespeare includes listening to this. It's That Shakespeare Life with my friend Cassidy Cash.
Because Jews weren't allowed on English soil, in order to take the jobs and come to England, it was a prerequisite that they convert and become Protestants. So they did, except that they didn't really. They attended church like all English people were required to do, and they were checked off on the list and they had their kids baptized, but they still practiced Judaism at home in secret.
Welcome to That Shakespeare Life with Cassidy Cash. Cassidy believes that if you desire to successfully learn or perform Shakespeare's plays, then understanding the real life and history of William Shakespeare himself is a must. That Shakespeare Life is the podcast that helps you go beyond the curtain of some of Shakespeare's most iconic works and explore the world of early modern England as Shakespeare would have lived it, learning from the writers, historians, and performers who know it best. And now, here's Cassidy.
Close to 300 years before Shakespeare's birth, in the year 1290, King Edward I expelled anyone of Jewish descent from England altogether. It would not be until 40 years after Shakespeare's death that Jews would be allowed to return to England. This law makes it somewhat confusing to find over 100 references to Jews and Jewry in Shakespeare's plays. How did he know about Jewish people if there weren't any in England? Additional history further muddles the waters with the story of Rodrigo Lopez, a Spanish Christian of Jewish ancestry that worked as a private physician to Elizabeth I. Ultimately, Lopez was executed, his sentence being influenced heavily by rampant anti-Semitism in England at the time. Lopez was not the only Jew in England for Shakespeare's lifetime, but his story shines a light on the plight of racial Jews, as well as anyone seeking to practice the Jewish religion who lived during the life of William Shakespeare. Here with us to tell us more about Lopez's life, Jews in early modern England, and the references to Jews found in Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice are our guests, Rona Silverbush and Sammy Plotkin. Rona Silverbush is an acting coach in New York City who has written and co-written several books, most notably Speak the Speech, Shakespeare's Monologues Illuminated with Sammy Plotkin. Hailed by Sir Derek Jacobi as, quote, a fabulous book, gloriously packed with information, end quote. Which I have to agree, it's overflowing with fun and useful information, which is what Rona and Sammy join us to share a little bit about today. Sammy Plotkin is co-author with Rona Silverbush of Speak the Speech, Shakespeare's Monologues Illuminated. Sammy is a playwright, mystery writer, and freelance writer. Sammy coaches writing and film editing and has been an actor and acting coach herself. She presents masterclasses and workshops in acting Shakespeare. Learn more about both our guests in the show notes for today's episode. Hello, Rona and Sammy. Welcome to That Shakespeare Life.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What roles in society did Jews hold for Shakespeare's lifetime? And what records do we have of how Jews were able to live in London and make a profitable wage?
Well, as you mentioned, Cassidy, in your intro, the Jews were expelled from England in 1290. So in theory, there were no Jews in England in Shakespeare's time, except that, of course, there were. They were just hiding in plain sight. So the Inquisition in Spain and Portugal brought many who converted to Christianity to England, where, yes, you had to pretend to be a Christian, just like you would have back at home, but where at least if they discovered you were faking it, they wouldn't burn you at the stake.
Right, exactly. But the English occasionally needed a Jewish person and kind of made a little dispensation to allow one in. Like, for example, when the universities wanted their students to study the Old Testament in, you know, its original archaic biblical Hebrew, they'd need someone who could teach them that, which meant they had to import a Jewish guy.
Mm-hmm. And then also there were the musicians. So Queen Elizabeth's dad, Henry VIII, wanted the best court musicians in all of Europe, and he got them. So the finest instrument musicians were a cohort of Jews from Portugal, and the finest wind instruments were the Bassano brothers.
The Bassano boys.
Right. They were a family of Venetian Jews of Moroccan Jewish descent. But because Jews weren't allowed on English soil, in order to take the jobs and come to England, it was a prerequisite that they convert and become Protestants. So they did, except that they didn't really. They attended church like all English people were required to do, and they were checked off on the list and they had their kids baptized, but they still practiced Judaism at home in secret.
Yeah, except, you know, theoretically, there were quote unquote no Jews in England in Shakespeare's day, sure.
It would seem that there was this outright objection to Jews as a race. No amount of conversion to Protestantism would be sufficient to allow them to stay in England. But there's these presence of figures like Rodrigo Lopez, who was not only Jewish, but operating at the highest levels of society in direct service to the Queen herself. That suggests that the law against Jews for Shakespeare's lifetime was aimed at keeping England religiously Protestant. And some of the things you've just mentioned about going to church and being checked off sort of backs that up as well. And the suggestion is that this is not a racial prejudice against Jewish, the race. And I think that's an important distinction for modern listeners who are used to racial disparagement being about an opposition to someone's skin color or an opposition to their ethnicity. Was England's official opposition to Jews a racial concern, or was this strictly a religious objection?
Okay, so yes, and also yes. It was both. And you're pointing to a conundrum for the English of that time that was really creating really kind of an existential crisis for them. See, the English people's concern with race in Shakespeare's day was completely intertwined with their very strong anti-Semitism. And you'd think there wouldn't be anti-Semitism, right, in the absence of actual Jews to hate on. But no, as we'll explain. And you're right that thinking of Jews as a race made them suspect as Protestants and created a further problem for them. So to explain what we're trying to say, let's decouple the race and the religion thing from the anti-Semitism thing for a moment, and we'll address one of them at a time. So it's important to factor nationalism into this too, and to understand the English completely conflated their nationalism with their religion. And a great example of that is like the fact that they believed in divine right, right? They believed that God put their rulers on the throne. So that's an example of right there of how like their nationality was just inseparable from their religion. And because England was an island, it felt very self-contained to Shakespeare's contemporaries. And so thinking there were no Jews on the island, as far as they knew, right, for 300 years at this point, both the nationality and the religion of the English were fused with their further notion of being a race. This is where race comes into it, to answer what you're saying, separate from the Jewish race. But now England was going through a crisis. And it was the same crisis that the Inquisition in Spain and Portugal had totally unleashed on all of Europe, which was what to make of the conversion of all those Jews from Spain and Portugal to Christianity, who then fled to England, because it turned the whole paradigm of religion, the two religions being separate races, on its head, right? Turned it upside down. They didn't know whether the Jews' race changed when they converted or stayed the same, even though they were now Christians. And both of those ideas were horrifying to them. Because if the Jews' race somehow changed because they converted, that struck fear into the hearts of the English, because they wondered, like, could the reverse also be true? Like, could I go to sleep at night like a really good English Christian and then wake up having, you know, quote unquote, turned Jew, which is what Shakespeare had Lancelot Gobbo in A Merchant of Venice worry about. They were sincerely terrified of that. But on the other hand, if the Jews' race remained the same, even if they converted, then that completely undoes the established English paradigm that the religions are separate races. And that was scary to Shakespeare's contemporaries, because it meant they had to re-examine like a long believed held and long held fact. And if we know anything about Elizabethans and Jacobeans, is that they hated having to replace long held beliefs about how the world was structured with new ones. So they were in a very destabilizing moment in Shakespeare's time. It was deeply unsettling to them. They were seriously rattled.
Right. Yeah. And so being seriously rattled like that brings us to the specific anti-Semitism part of this. So anti-Semitism was already really deeply ingrained in English culture by the time the Jews were expelled in 1290. And then, if anything, it just grew in their imaginations, precisely because your imagination can totally run amok without a specific example. They didn't have an overtly Jewish neighbor around to contradict the grotesque stereotypes. So first of all, there was this by now centuries old and really deeply held belief that Jews were responsible for the death of Jesus. And they then weren't. A huge offshoot of that that grew out of that was what's known as the blood libel. And so for those who aren't familiar with the term blood libel, it's the idea, the belief that Jews would routinely abduct and murder Christians, often Christian children, and usually that the blood of those Christians would be used for various ritual purposes, such as to bake into the matzah or drink instead of wine at Passover. And scholars have recorded over 100 supposed ritual uses of Christian blood. So we can really see from that the degree to which the English imagination was just going wild.
Well, I'll never be able to read Titus Andronicus the same way again.
Right? Exactly. That's exactly right. You know, Aaron's of a different race. And exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So a famous example that was still really current in their minds in Shakespeare's time was the murder of a little orphan boy, this poor kid. His name is Little Hugh of Lincoln, back before the Jews were exiled. So it was like 1255, 35 years before they were exiled by King Edward so he could keep all their stuff. So the murder was falsely pinned on the nearby Jewish community, and 19 Jews were executed for it. And then they were exiled shortly thereafter, all of them. So 300 years later, this myth that Jews routinely did this was going strong.
Rodrigo Lopez is a prominent example of a Jew who managed to do well in England, working as a private physician to the Queen of England. And he wasn't necessarily a secret Jew because this was known about him. And after he becomes a physician, Lopez was accused of being this converted Jew, that he was a Christian, but secretly practicing Jewish religion behind the scenes. And ultimately, Rona and Sammy point in their work to research that includes the Earl of Essex accusing Lopez of trying to poison the Queen. Rona, can you share with us why accusing a Jew of trying to poison the Queen, poison specifically there, was a major concern to monarchs of this period? Why was it significant that he's being accused of poisoning her?
Okay, so I want to just say we don't actually know if he was still a Jew in his heart or a true convert, because his family had converted when he was still a child. But because he was of Jewish origin, that was good enough in the minds of the English, so just to clarify that. And what you're really rightly pointing to, Cassidy, is that Essex's accusation fit what had become a popular trope at the time, which was that Jews were fond of going around Europe poisoning royalty. Mm-hmm. Connecting the dots to what Sammy was just explaining, that trope about Jews poisoning royalty, of course, is just another variant on right. the theme of blood libel.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so Lopez was, of course, he was not trying to poison the Queen. And that's a long story, but really, like, his main crime was just that he became a favorite of the Queen. And Essex was really protective of his position as the favorite. So he was very unhappy about that. And as Rona said, you know, Lopez had converted, well, his family converted while he was still a child and before they even came to England. So we don't even know, you know, he may have really been sincerely a Christian at that time, but it didn't matter either way. Essex, because of the blood libel, he was able to play that card and he got Lopez convicted and sentenced to death.
Right. And then to your point, Cassidy, when he's up on the platform at his public execution, right before he's hanged, drawn, and quartered, Lopez proclaims his innocence and he says, "I love my queen as I love my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ." And the crowd like just went bananas. I mean, they jeered, they started shouting, "Hang the Jew, hang the Jew." So
And Queen Elizabeth did not want him killed. She really, well, first of all, she believed him to be innocent. And also now she has to get a new physician in chief. And she didn't want to sign that death warrant.
Yeah, she was really bummed about the whole thing.
Plays like Marlowe's Jew of Malta and Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice demonstrate an interest in Jews for popular storytelling. Rona and Sammy, are these plays influenced by Lopez's story directly? And were plays about Jews a hot topic for performances during this period?
The Jew of Malta was written by Christopher Marlowe a few years before the Lopez affair, actually. So he wrote it in 1589 or 1590, and Lopez was executed in 1594. So, and in fact, Marlowe himself wasn't alive when Lopez was executed. He had already been like stabbed in the eye the year before in that famous tavern brawl. But Philip Henslowe, who is that famous theater impresario and who owned Marlowe's play at the time that Essex framed Lopez, he knew a cash cow when he saw one. So he revived the Jew of Malta and just cashed in on this anti-Semitism that flared up around the Lopez affair. And actually, in fact, his theater company went into rehearsal on the play the day Lopez was arrested.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That same day. I mean, like, they heard Lopez got arrested and they were like, dig out the costumes. Wait, where do we store the fake nose?
Yeah. And Rona is not joking, actually, about that. So the actor playing the Jewish Uber villain, Barabbas, he wore a fake long nose.
No, I totally am inflating that.
No, I'm not exaggerating. I'm underplaying it. Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Insane.
Yeah.
But yeah. So
the play itself was written earlier. And so it wasn't influenced by the Lopez affair, but its revival at the time definitely was.
It totally was. But meanwhile, as for Shakespeare, as you know, Cassidy, it was common in those days for playwrights to respond to one another's works with related works of their own. And mm-hmm. Shakespeare was not going to be outdone, either creatively or like financially, by a rival theater company. So he instantly sat down to write his company's Jew play. And here's how he made it really obvious that it was a retort to Marlowe's revival. It's so funny. So for anyone who doesn't know the play The Merchant of Venice, we need to explain that Shylock, the Jew of the play, is not the merchant of the title. The Merchant of Venice that Shakespeare named the play for is a character who's a Christian character named Antonio, who borrows money from Shylock the Jew. So in fact, Antonio's that one that Shylock famously wants to extract a pound of flesh from, which, of course, side note, if you don't recognize it by now, is that that's once again an example of, say it all with me at home, blood libel. But I digress. The point is that cleverly, in response to Marlowe's The Jew of Malta, Shakespeare basically entitled his play like The Christian of Venice, which is, you know, him. That's so Shakespeare. So to answer your question, the Lopez affair inspired a revival of the already written play by Marlowe, The Jew of Malta. And then the financial success of the revival of The Jew of Malta, in turn, inspired the writing by Shakespeare of The Merchant of Venice.
Mm-hmm. Rona and Sammy's work talks about the surprising contrast between Shakespeare's portrayal of Jews in Merchant of Venice versus Marlowe's rendition of Jews in The Jew of Malta, pointing out that Shakespeare's monologues defends Jews, and the ending of the play is ultimately a happy one, with the souls of the characters being saved. Rona and Sammy, what do these details reveal about the time period when Shakespeare was writing these plays? And is Shakespeare's portrayal contrary to popular opinion at the time?
So it's interesting to contrast, actually, what Shakespeare did with his Jewish character versus what Marlowe had done with his. So Marlowe's Barabbas was quintessentially evil, and he had his fortune taken from him. Then he wants revenge, so he goes on a rampant murder spree. He even kills his own daughter. And so audiences were very happy to see him die painfully in a vat of boiling oil at the end of the play. On the other hand, Shakespeare gave Shylock a much stronger reason to hate the Christians. So not only are they horrible to him in the moment of the play, but we learn that they have been outright persecuting him for years before the play happens. So, I know, which for the record still does not excuse his actions, but Shakespeare is giving Shylock a strong motivation for his hatred and saying it's a normal human feeling that he would have under these circumstances, which he says in his famous speech. And so that is a little step forward in recognizing the humanity of Jewish people. And so in keeping with this, rather than boiling Shylock in oil at the end, Shakespeare gives Shylock what his audience would have considered a happy ending. His life is spared, and his sentence for seeking the death of Antonio includes the requirement that he convert to Christianity. So happy, happy ending for the Elizabethan audience.
They would have loved that. And also, we can contrast the daughters, because Barabbas's daughter gets whacked by her evil dad, right? And if you contrast this with Shylock's daughter, Jessica, who doesn't get killed by her own dad, she's a sympathetically written character who elopes with a Christian early-ish in the play and thus has already converted by the time Shylock has to, you know, so as Sammy said, by the end of the play, both of these souls are saved, you know, huzzah, happy ending.
Mm-hmm. Happy ending. Like you made a good point, Cassidy. So all of this kind of points to the suggestion that although Shakespeare may have held his contemporaries' views about Jews, he was a person of his time, he also seems to have been more progressive in his thinking than his contemporaries were.
Yeah, I agree, Sam. I think that, you know, Shakespeare, he clearly, he wanted to try to understand Shylock's experience of being persecuted. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't just want to write a stock Machiavellian character like Marlowe.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is one of the many things that Rona and I love about Shakespeare, that he just had empathy for every kind of person, which meant that he was brilliant at writing every kind of character.
It's really surprising in that play to me that he's able to get away with that much positivity and support for the Jewish people and this kind of compassion that he shows. It definitely seems to fly in the face of what you're describing as the societal norm for that time period. So I think that was an expert balancing there of the various forces going on in the culture at the time.
Right. But although, you know, our contemporary productions, like we are accustomed to seeing contemporary interpretations, which feel more positive because of decisions that directors have made. Whereas what you would have seen in Shakespeare's time was, you know, a different type of interpretation that would have felt different to the audience at the time. Like it wouldn't have felt as radical, right?
Yeah, not all the way to Al Pacino.
Right.
You know, it's part of, like, the way to Al Pacino, but not all the way to Al Pacino.
But not all the way, right? Still acceptable and fulfilling within what their beliefs were and a big moneymaker.
Now, Merchant of Venice provides an obvious example of the early modern perspective on Jews. And as you pointed out, it can be labeled Shakespeare's Jewish play in response to The Jew of Malta. And it does. It contains tons of references to Jews, but it's hardly Shakespeare's only play to mention Jews. There are references to Jews and the word Jewry in Antony and Cleopatra, Henry IV, Part 1, Henry V, Love's Labour's Lost, Macbeth, Merry Wives of Windsor, Midsummer Night's Dream, Much Ado About Nothing, Richard II, and Two Gentlemen of Verona. And that's just what I was able to find with a basic search putting this interview together. There may be even more examples than that. All of these references to Jews raises the question of whether secret Jews were personal for Shakespeare. Is there any evidence to suggest William Shakespeare may have had personal connections to Jews living in London?
Okay, so, you know, the first thing that pops to mind in response to your question is something that came up in a way in the last one, which is that he also was of his time, right? He was progressive, and I think he pushed people forward, but he also was of his time. So the references that you mentioned from those other plays are references by and large casually to the people saying that they're being heretical, right? So when Shakespeare's characters say, if I do X, Y thing, Z thing that I don't want to do, I'm a very Jew, right? Which are those, what those kinds of references are that you're referring to. The characters are saying they'd be acting in a way that's the opposite of their normal good character and their normal inclinations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a prime example of how the English of Shakespeare's time, they didn't even need to know Jews to have their stereotypes of them. And this is where that comes out very casually, you know. But you ask a really good question, Cassidy. It's like, you know, which is one of those fun things to do, to think about, you know, Shakespeare's actual life. Might Shakespeare...
It's kind of what we do here.
Exactly. Exactly. Which exactly. is, yeah. And it's important to do. I think it's important, as you say, like for actors to know in order to be able to understand the context in which he was writing and understand what his characters are even talking about, right? Even like here, they wouldn't know that what I'm a very Jew means if they don't understand the attitude towards Jews, right? So the question, though, is might Shakespeare have had any personal connections to Jews living in London that he knew were actually practicing Jews? That's like the interesting intrigue question to contemplate.
Exactly. Because we most certainly know that he knew people who were crypto Jews. So because, you know, for one thing, he performed at court and these Portuguese and Phoenician court musicians performed at court and sometimes together. But so did he know that anyone he knew was still a practicing Jew? That's the real question. And our sense is that he probably did. And one possibility that has recently been really popular is this. If your listeners know much about Shakespeare's sonnets, they will know that he wrote a bunch of them about a quote unquote dark lady with whom he was having an affair. And so, okay, that is, if the sonnets are taken as truth, which some people say they might have been fiction, but Rona and I have talked about this, and we both kind of feel that they're too intimate, personal, and raw to have been fiction. So
definitely,
if they're taken... Yes, as truth. Then so a current popular guess as to who the dark lady of the sonnets might have been is a young woman named Amelia Bassano Lanier. So yes, the daughter of one of those Bassano boys that we were talking about earlier, the ones who are the wind instrument players who came from Venice and conveniently converted to Christianity to accept that gig for Henry VIII's court musicians. So, you know, it's a chain of ifs. If the Bassanos did continue to practice Judaism, which we think they did, but then if they also raised their kid in the Jewish tradition, and if Amelia was indeed the dark lady of Shakespeare's sonnets, well, then, yeah, Shakespeare knew at least one Jewish person quite intimately.
Yeah, very intimately. But of course, that's all conjecture, right?
Right.
But whether he knew Amelia or not and knew her intimately, Shakespeare's more nuanced and complicated Jewish characters that we were just discussing, I think they speak to the idea that Jews weren't just an abstraction to him. Mm-hmm. You know, he was really a brilliant observer of the people around him. And, you know, he was like sort of taking notes all the time on them, right? And we're pretty sure he knew the full score of some of the people that he knew and interacted with.
Yeah. And we obviously, we can't ever know for sure, but yeah, it would shock us if he didn't really.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have all of the, as I say, I think numerous times on the show, we don't have affidavits for these things where we can say, definitely we can prove this, but certainly he was knowledgeable. We can say he was knowledgeable about the Jewish faith and the Jewish practice and the Jewish race. So, I mean, he knew enough to do all of the prosthetics. I think that's just, I can't get over the nose. But
I don't know if Shylock wore nose. We just know that Barabbas.
We know that Barabbas did.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So we can't pin that one on Shakespeare.
Yeah, but
okay. Well, anyway, he researched it somewhere. So it's nice to know that whether he knew someone personally or not, we can't say that he knew what he was talking about when he wrote these characters.
For sure.
Now, I know we would love to learn more about this topic. And as the experts researching Jews in England for Shakespeare's lifetime, what can you point us towards in terms of books or resources we should explore if we want to learn more about what we've heard today?
Okay, so obviously our first reference is going to be our book, Speak This Speech. Oh, I think Rona has it on the shelf there.
I do.
And it's chock full of fun factoids that contextualize Shakespeare's plays and the characters and stories also. And we completely agree with you, Cassie, that for actors to best perform his work and also for audiences to best understand it, they need as much context as they can get. So that was something we were really determined sort of to tackle and provide for actors in our book. And we also recommend James Shapiro's book. It's Shakespeare and the Jews. It came out with a 20th anniversary edition in 2016. And, you know, today we can only just begin to kind of scratch the surface of a discussion of this whole topic. And James Shapiro goes into a great deal of depth about it in his book.
Yeah. And then Smithsonian Magazine has a great article. It's 400 years later, scholars still debate whether Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice is anti-Semitic. So that's a mouthful.
Yeah.
But it's a good article. And we also like two articles from Folger's Shakespeare Library. The longer one, I'm going to mangle the names of the authors, but it's The Merchant of Venice, A Modern Perspective. Oh, no, not that one. That's Professor Alexander Leggett of the University of Toronto. And the short one is the one I'm not going to pronounce right. It's about Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice by Barbara Mowat and Paul Wehrstein, I think, is how you pronounce those.
Rona and Sammy's book is such a great guide for actors of Shakespeare's plays in particular. So I definitely support you checking that
out.
Thank you. And the other books that they've mentioned here are wonderful places to start your research on this topic as well. I'll link to, in the show notes for today's episode, all of these resources so you can go there directly. In the show notes, you'll also be able to find more information about our guests, direct links to their work, and a list of resources you can use to learn more about Jews in England and Amelia Lanier and all of the Bassano Boyd links that you can enjoy. So definitely go there. If you're inspired by what you've learned this week and want to explore the play Merchant of Venice and perhaps Titus Andronicus through the lens of Jewish history in modern England, I encourage you to see these plays in performance. So I will place links to where you can watch the show notes for free on YouTube in our show notes today, as well as links to related podcast episodes where we explore sort of tangential rabbit trails related to today's episode as well. So make sure you go there to find all of these things. They are at CassidyCash.com/episode317. And I will remind you of that URL later in the episode. We ask everyone this next question here at That Shakespeare Life, Rona and Sammy. What is the one book you would take with you on a deserted island? My friends in England tell me I'm supposed to allow you the complete works of Shakespeare and a copy of the Bible. So your choice would be in addition to those. And you may both each select a desert island book.
Okay, so I have to ask, because I'm a total geek, do we get to pick the editions of the Bible and the complete works?
Yes.
Because otherwise I'll probably go insane on the desert island even sooner than most people would. So, yes?
Good. Yes, okay. Absolutely. Yes. Specify
Thank
editions.
You. Okay. That's a relief. Apart from those, you know, I could give a lot of different kinds of answers, but I'm going to pick E.L. Doctorow's Ragtime. I think Doctorow, when he wrote it, he went out on a huge stylistic limb, and I think it paid off enormously. I think he has Shakespeare's sense of rhythm of words, and he managed to actually infuse the novel with the syncopated sort of rhythm and feeling of ragtime music, which I think is an astonishing accomplishment. Mm-hmm. I think there's not a single superfluous word in that novel. I just think it's just about as perfect a piece of writing that isn't Shakespeare as a person can find. And that's coming from a Shakespeare buff. So Ragtime.
Yeah. So, I agree with Rona about Doctorow, and I'm going to call her on my cell phone and ask her to read it to me from my island.
Done.
And also I'm going to also insist on choices in the editions. I would like some dispensation of my own. The Oxford English Dictionary is actually one work, but it comes in 20 volumes. Can I have the whole thing?
Yes, you may. I've actually allowed encyclopedia sections before. So
now
so,
she yes, tells
the,
us.
The options, the options are broad.
And also, can I have some, like, just some paper and some pens? Just, you know, for writing.
She'll get back to us.
I love the assumptions people make about our desert island situation. One day I'm going to write down.
You know, my bags are packed.
Yes, all the things. Can I have my suitcase too, please?
So I said to Rona, we were talking about what are we going to choose? And I said, I think I know the right thing to choose, a survival guide, because I will not survive one night on a
That's
desert
very
island.
Very practical, yes.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay. I can safely say that no other guest on That Shakespeare Life has selected Ragtime. So okay. I think between that and your survival guide, your paper and your whole collection of books there, you will be well set up on your desert island. So I think you'll have a delightful time there with those.
Still not looking forward to it.
So what's next for you? What are you working on now that you're excited about?
Oh my gosh. So we're really excited that we are working on another Shakespeare-related writing project together. And this one is radically different from Speak the Speech. It's a television series and it's set in Shakespeare's London, but Shakespeare is a character in it, but he's not the main character. So we're having a lot of fun.
That does sound like fun. We'll look forward to seeing the next installment of The Greatest Project coming from Rona and Sammy. Thank you both so much. This has been a mountain of a topic to cover here today, and I appreciate you joining us to break it down and share with us the history behind what was going on with the Jews in Shakespeare's plays and how that related to the Jews in 16th and 17th century England. This has been a really fun conversation to have with both of you, and I appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much for having us. What a delight. Really a delight. Thank you.
We've covered several resources about the history of Jews in England for today's show, and we have gathered them all together in a helpful list that we've packed into the show notes for today. You can find this at CassidyCash.com/episode315. While you're there, if you would like to go even further into the history of today's topic, I invite you to expand our detailed show notes using the Become a Patron button. You can either use that button to log in as a patron, or you can join us as a patron, and it expands all the insider extras right there on the page. This week, you'll find illustrations of Rodrigo Lopez, a family portrait of the Bassano musicians, some 16th century images and primary documents that explain blood libel a little better and further, more information on Amelia Lanier, and more. All of these extras are right there in the show notes for today at CassidyCash.com/episode315. That's CassidyCash.com/EP315. That Shakespeare Life is made possible by listeners just like you who sign up to be our patrons. To say thank you for supporting our show, patrons not only get access to the research that goes into each episode, but they also get bonus episodes and the opportunity to submit questions for an upcoming interview. Our patrons area on Patreon includes a video library, virtual tours, and an entire educator section that maps out exactly how to use our show to complete a full 35-week year of Shakespeare history, including hands-on activity kits that coordinate with our show and with Shakespeare's plays. And that's just a fun way to let you try out some of the history you hear about here on the show. Find out more, explore all the extras, and sign up today at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That's patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That Shakespeare Life is researched and produced by me, Cassidy Cash. Our audio engineer is Gary Mayholm. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. I'm Cassidy Cash, and I hope you learned something new about the Bard. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to That Shakespeare Life. As always, the best conversations happen after the episode over at CassidyCash.com. Become a part of a vibrant Shakespeare conversation by adding your voice over at the website. Until next time, remember, when you want to know William Shakespeare, you have to go behind the curtain and into That Shakespeare Life.